hello and welcome to the Workforce Excellence Show, episode number 9. In this episode, we're discussing ethics and inclusion and the benefits to both employees and the business. Now, I'm joined by three very experienced people today who are involved with the Workforce Excellence Conference in September of this year. And from that, some really interesting conversations started. However, we had to move on due to time constraints. So I thought, let's get together again, and here we are. So I'm joined by Ed Jarvis, who is responsible for culture and change within Serco's justice and immigration business, as well as being the global chair of the group's LGBT Plus network. His background is in leading and managing complex transformation and performance improvement programs. Ed operates in a specialist role combining business improvement and operational excellence with the creation of diverse and inclusive working structures and operational environments. Dr. Anne Nordcliffe is a researcher at the School of Engineering, Technology and Design at Christchurch University, Canterbury. Her research is in the mobile learning technology. She is currently researching developing pedagogy to improve users' learning experience. Josephine Erickson's educational background is in business management, administration and operations, having received a first class honours from IT Carlo. She is currently completing her master's in ethics and CSR in DCU. Josephine has 13 years experience in the pharmaceutical industry, working with Allergan, followed by Merck Group, and in 2017, joining Bausch Health Companies as supply chain specialist. So, hello, and thank you very much for joining, Ed, Anne, and Josephine.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
No problem at all. Listen, I will kick straight off into some questions here, and this one's for yourself, Ed. You've talked about being a disruptor, in particular to the strange times that we live in. Can you give us some more details about that?
Yeah, so disruptor is because I think where we currently are is pathetic. I welcome the moves that we see in the diversity and inclusion spaces. Anything that's positive is welcomed. However, when I look at the rate of change, so the speed at which we will get to where we need to be, I think that we need to have some very realistic conversations. And no amount of backslapping and self-congratulations and appearing in a top 100 does that. What actually does that is complex, difficult questions that marry the problem with the solution. So at the moment, we've got a lot of people within diversity and inclusion and a lot of people within industry all nodding, you know, like the famous car insurance advert. Racism is bad. Sexism is bad. We need to get better. So we're all violently agreeing with each other. What I'm not seeing is the commercial steps that would be required to fix any other business problem. So in the same way, if I had a revenue problem, if I had an advertising problem, if I had a marketing problem, if I had a territory issue, if I wanted to go into, you know, a sales program, I would deploy a whole range of solutions that my organization is familiar in using. When it comes to D&I, it gets pushed into a softer HR to pick up, HR to solve issue. And actually, until organizations position it that it is a commercial problem, because it is, there is a commercial upside, there is a P&L upside, there's an EBIT upside, there's an ethical upside, you know, there's an innovation upside. And in the war on talent, talent will not be attracted, nor will it be retained in your organization unless you get this right. So it is a commercial problem. But until we put that lens on it, we're not going to see that rate of change. You know, 99 years for women to get parity, pathetic, not good enough. It's not acceptable. My grandkids' kids are going to see parity for women in business. So if that's women who are our mothers, our sisters, our, you know, our cousins, our aunts, our daughters, what does that look like for a trans person or, you know, a person with of color with a disability? So that's what I mean by disruptor. We've got to have proper conversations that and get comfortable with that uncomfortable truth that, that the rate of change is not good enough. And what are we going to do about it?
What would you have any, just in relation to that change being poor, would there be any recommendations to improve this rate? Can it be improved?
Yeah, so the solution is super complex. Are you ready? Mm-hmm.
I think.
Define what you want good to look like, enshrine it in performance management, and link it to individual responsibility within your organization. It is no different to any other commercial problem. The problem that we've got is that the FTSE 350, 60% of them don't collect data. So if you're telling me we've got a business problem where we're not collecting the data on ethnicity and you know some of the protected characteristics, then I say to you, you're not serious about inclusion and diversity, because if you can't baseline it, how are you going to measure your performance? So collecting your data is number one. And then it comes to your, if you want your biggest bang for your buck, recruitment and hiring. So who is going out there and attracting the talent to your business, and are they equipped to do it? I would argue that if they tell you in a pitch they're really good at inclusion and diversity, of course they're going to say that. You want to see what their track record is. So that's, again, managing your supplier. And I would also suggest you've probably invested more in manual handling training for your hiring managers than you actually have in inclusive interview techniques, implicit biases, peer reviews, collaborating results. So, I'm flippant and facetious, but the solutions are not the problem here. The implementation is, and I recognize that. The implementation is the difficult bit. But the solutions are 101 of how you would fix a commercial problem.
Thanks for that, Ed. Just some of the things that you've mentioned there, of course, will no doubt have an impact on a company's bottom line too. And Anne, I know that you've talked about how inclusive teams can impact a company's bottom line. Would you mind elaborating on that?
So the good examples that the products that have come out because the teams haven't been inclusive, the classic ones often are in software engineering. So if you remember 2 years ago, Cardiff Police took used software commissioned for facial recognition for crime. And it was only recognised white faces. It wouldn't recognise females, and it wouldn't recognise BME people. And the people who developed that were white males, typical software engineering teams developing that, and they will test it on themselves. So an alpha, what becomes a beta release to a company, will be only internally tested. And because the teams are not diverse, they're not questioning. It's the mirror image. They're not questioning those unconscious biases. Just as for years, products of cars have neglected the fact that 51% of the population is female. They are designed for males to drive and before automatics, but even still, the gearboxes on cars which they do then aim at the female market are too heavy. They forget the female upper body strength is 40% less. Without having female engineers in that environment, challenging what is being designed because they test it on themselves, they're missing that fundamental first step of recognizing this inclusive market. So you are perpetuating the problem of producing products that only tailor 49% of the market. So you're missing out on that revenue stream. Now, the industry that recognised some of the game changers of that is like the gaming industry. More women game than men.
Right.
But it's the candy floss games, the Candy Crush games. And because the teams that were involved in that were more inclusive and they thought it through about what does a female want to do, they want shorter bursts of games. So they're not into your Grand Theft Auto. So the opportunity of making those revenue streams is being thinking more inclusively.
Great. Thank you. Just something that comes to mind, and when you're talking about that, it's something that comes to mind to me is culture. And Josephine, if I could just bring you in, you've talked about building a culture of trust. What does a culture of trust look like to you?
Well, I think a culture of trust in a company, I think, is one where a company remains committed to complying with laws and regulations and also adopt an ethical work culture that is lived, which is very, very important by those leading the organization and those setting the good example for all. And I think just reflecting on what was just said by Ed and Anne, it like that whole culture of, like, we keep saying the right things, but in actual fact, it doesn't really translate to how we operate and having all those, you know, the uncomfortable conversations. And, you know, typically we tend to kind of tiptoe around all the difficult areas, but we like to kind of put them on a piece of paper just to make sure that they're kind of being covered, but it doesn't actually translate to how we live. So buying and follow through, I mean, you need to have the right codes and practices in place, but it is so important. It's vital. It doesn't matter what you have written down if you don't have buy-in from all and actually follow through on a corporate level, follow through on the organizational values and the code of conduct. If that doesn't happen, it will just undo any good that you tried to do by writing the codes in the first place. So I think by doing that, it subsequently creates an environment of trust, because if you work for somebody, work with somebody who actually does do and follow through on the code of conduct that you try to live by, then you will, of course, trust that person. You would trust your employee. If they do the contrary to what they're saying, same as in any other situation in life, you're not going to trust them. If you know that you have senior management team that you know, they take part in bribery scandals, but they're saying to you that this is our code of conduct and this is what you need to live by, it doesn't match. You know, it doesn't, it will create an environment of distrust, which is obviously the opposite of what we're trying to achieve. So anyone engaging in unethical and unlawful behavior is not somebody that you're going to want to commit to and trust and work with long term. So same as you would in, you know, same in any other relationship that you may have in life.
Sure.
Yeah.
If I could just move on to a bit about employee accountability, because I know you've mentioned that before.
Employee accountability. Yeah, I mean, I suppose from my own experience, what I've seen and when I read about these, I mean, you do need employee accountability from everybody. Everybody needs, I mean, that's a huge part of just for the circle to, I suppose, work for you to be able to achieve long-term, you know, sustainability and long-term success in a company. But you do need to have the foundations. There's no point in trying to build on it and even try and, you know, you can have, I've seen companies that have, they try to push for the employees and they try to push this idea that it's all kind of bottom up. But if you're met by a brick wall, it doesn't matter how much you try and be accountable and do the right thing and you try and live by the codes that have been implemented and are being published by your company, if that's not being lived through and if it's not being followed by senior management, and if what they're saying to you is not actually what you see happening, it doesn't really matter what you can do. You can only do as much as you can do as opposed in the bottom. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to be throughout, and it needs to be equal, and it needs to be need buy-in from everybody. Basically, there's only so much you can do.
Moving on from that, I guess it's essential that we're hiring the right people than we can for our company. And Anne, I know I've heard you talk about the different ways people apply for their jobs and how they write their CVs. Could you go into detail about that?
So some of the works that's come out of Surrey University was that Maxfield identified that women won't apply for adverts if the wording of the adverts is too masculine. So leader is seen as a masculine word, whereas manager is seen as a feminine word, because they'll look at the terminology in those adverts and interpret them of I can't do that. So women typically will look at the criteria for a job and think they have to meet all that criteria. In academics, their roles, they need to be researchers and teachers, but the females tend to be, their careers tend to be sidelined more to the teaching side. And so when they put forward their CV, they know my organisation's Christian-based university, so the ethos is very much about community and teaching. So they will put forward their CV very, very focused on teaching, whereas the male academics who apply, I'm not joking, I get 80 pages, CVs, the kitchen sink, the lot. All about their research, a little bit about their teaching. They're not really keen to tell me about their teaching. Lots and lots of research, how brilliant they are, tick, tick, tick at everything. And I'm having to choose a different approach to sift the female candidates over the male candidates. And when I interview them, the females do have the research background, it's just not on the CV. And we're drawing it out at the interview stage, and they are, and when we are interviewing, so we interview, you know, Caribou, both male and female, we're often hiring the females because they meet the criteria, because the job is 50-50, you know, 80% teaching, 20% research.
I think that's really important, but getting back to, it reminds me of Ed's point when we were talking back in September, just about how, you know, we need to recognize people like ourselves in the organization. Ed, would you mind just delving into that a bit more?
Yeah, and just before I do, sorry, Anne and Josephine are totally on the money with those themes. If there's anything to pull out of this, you know, when Anne talked about representation and that diversity of thought in the decision-making process, you know, absolutely it has consequences in industry. I think my biggest concern is the consequence it has in the judicial system. You know, you are more than three times more likely to be arrested if you are not white, and you are three times more likely to go to court, to go to trial, if you are not white, and 93% of all court judges are white. So, you know, we see this filter right across our society and, you know, devastating communities in that way. So I couldn't agree with the more. And when Josephine talks about that lack of credibility and authenticity when it comes to culture, that again just rings so true, because if you say you're really invested, you're really, you know, you really want to improve this, but yet you're not, you know, giving any direction, talking about what good looks like, you know, having an opinion, saying it's not good enough. You know, if you haven't got that leadership credibility at the top saying, I actually don't know everything about this, but I'm committed to learning and I'm committed to improving, then people just don't buy it, you know, and it loses that credibility.
That's a competitive edge. I know you were talking about a competitive edge back in September, and that employees can both be the solution and the barrier. In a way, that's kind of similar in a way to what you're saying there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, because they're now trying to, no, I mean, I could talk about Siemens a lot more and I won't, because even the person who was brought in trying to make a difference, he had to leave because he was too aggressive in his, you know, the KPIs were still too aggressive. And I mean, business is business. And I think sometimes you have to try and find, we're still finding our feet, I think, in that kind of more modern way. I mean, like Ed said, it's not happening quick enough. And all the, you know, these conversations have to be had, and diversity and inclusion is key, is 100%. And it does tie in with that, because what I was referring to is essentially resource-based view, but really, really focusing on the people. And again, with, you know, the buy-in and achieving an ethical working culture. For me, an ethical working culture, there has to be trust, there has to be diversity, there has to be inclusion. You have to be able to be trusted to have the difficult conversations, and you have to, and you invest in your people. You have to give a little to gain a lot. But if you truly invest in your people, you make them feel valued, included, and you really, you invest in them, they will give you back tenfold. So that's your competitive edge. You make sure that people are included. And it's not this, I mean, again, I'm a woman, I live in a foreign country. I mean, certainly as a woman, I have very often, you know, you've had these little comments of, oh, you know, oh, we're very, you know, we're not sexist and we do all the right things. But then again, it's the little put down joke. And it's the little, we don't really want to listen to you, you know. And I have to nearly shout across the table if I want to be heard. You know, it's, you know, so it's really just making sure that the people, you know, that you invest in people to ultimately, you know, you will see monetary gain, you know, from that. There's a lot of research behind how, in Google, for example, I mean, Google is another company that, regardless of what we think of their policies and or perhaps even its culture, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to work for Google. I think I'm probably too old, because I think the average age is 27. But right. they very famously talk about how their competitive edge is their organizational culture. You know, they go above and beyond for their employees and try and create a very comfortable working environment and make sure that people do progress and no one is forgotten and all of that. And they really do focus on their people, and that they do openly and famously talk about that being sure. their competitive edge. So that's
I think you're absolutely right there. I just thought, just moving off the off our track a bit, is there anything, Ed or Anne, do you have anything to add further from that before moving on?
In terms of competitive edge, I think Josephine's totally on the money. You know, and I mentioned before that if I was a shareholder in an organization that was performing badly with DEI, I would be asking myself, is that organization managing my money well? Because if anybody else walked into a boardroom and said, I can give you a 30% upside commercially, and it's going to improve my investment in your business, and you year on year ignored that, there's very few opportunities of this size that you can walk into a boardroom and say, I can impact your P&L through innovation. We know that McKinsey are throwing out, you know, research papers every year. They're screaming it. The EBIT performance, you know, the commercial upside for inclusion and diversity, the boards that have better gender representation and their performance, it's all out there. And boards are willfully, in my view, in many occasions, not grasping that commercial opportunity, but where they will get hit, and in my view, rightly hit, is when we look at the shift of demographics of people coming into the workforce after us. So the new waves of entrants into industry and then progressing through management and leadership, they are a totally different kettle of fish to baby boomer generations or even my generation. They're totally different. They grew up not knowing anything other than the internet. They grew up in totally different geopolitical times. If organizations aren't preparing for that cultural shift within their organizations, they won't win the war on talent. We know there's going to be skills gaps. So you don't get a bigger commercial crisis to say, in 5 to 10 years, my organization is going to struggle to attract the best talent. Without the best talent, we can't, you know, perform. So there's a massive commercial upside to it.
Sure. Thanks. Anne, is there anything that you'd like to add on to that at all before we move on? We've just lost your audio.
Highlighting about that missing talent, the Royal Academy of Engineers highlighted in 2014, white males were achieving 85% graduate roles. British Asian black engineering students on graduating were only achieving 14% were getting into engineering graduate roles. And that is the level of the unconscious bias with employers. And we keep moaning about the engineering skill gap. And ironically, that gap could be filled with all the British Asian black engineers that we were generating and we are generating and the employers weren't grabbing. And I think the big game changer has to be the Mayor of London, who has recognised that London is 40% now British Asian black communities, and it is changing fast, and he's taken the long view, and any business that wants a contract in London, so HS2, the Thames Crossing, the Thames Water Barrier, have all been stipulated. They have to have 40% diversity inclusivity across their teams. And this is male and female and Asian, black communities, trans, etc., right across 40%. And it's got to be from the cleaner right up to the top level. Yeah. Otherwise, they can't win the contracts. And that has to also filter into the supply chain. Okay. So they're examining every aspect of that. And it is challenging businesses. It's making them really look what is defining talent and what talent have we been missing on.
Sure, sure. Thanks, Anne. Just before we... Sorry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, Chris, really quickly, that is totally on the money. And I think where we are blind in our society is to understand the impact of that. So, you know, Anne talked about not getting the roles, not getting the jobs, but you roll it out and, you know, 63% of the population own their own home. unless you are Black, African, and you 17% of that community own their own home. So there are real implications of getting this wrong that are affecting real people's lives and communities. And we need to, and that's what I meant at the beginning about disrupting. We need to really look at what that's doing to our society.
Mass is taught totally alienated with no practical use to it. And it puts people off. And once you link it to the applied things, the penny starts dropping. They understand.
My daughter said something interesting to me the other day, and that she was doing maths, and she said, "Oh, well, maths isn't for me. It's not my thing." And she's actually very good at it when we're going through her homework, you know. And I thought, "What do you mean? It's, you know, it's not your thing? Like, whose thing is it? I mean, it's like a language kind of a thing, you know." I mean, I found that fascinating that she'd arrived at that conclusion somehow, even though she was.
And it's what's frightening is they learn this at 4 and 5 in the classroom, and it's often a male. So research has been shown has actually monitored the language that happens on primary school tables. There's a fascinating piece of work done by a primary school teacher. And I've seen these transcripts, and I've sat there and gone, yeah, I witnessed the same conversations with 18-year-olds of putting the girls down. Oh, no, girls aren't good at maths. And that's why another 4-year-old boy will say that to a girl.
Right. They're picking that up.
They've learned that in the home. They've heard grandparents say it. And so it becomes culture. That unconscious bias is ingrained much early on before we can, you know, we've got to unpick parents, grandparents to stop it happening in the home before they hit school.
You know what we're kind of, not. I'm not saying that we're all taught this, but you know, again, these kind of, you know, these little jokes and the little things that you're told kind of growing up and as an adult, and, you know, how, and especially, you know, for a female, well, say it in a way to make him think it was his idea. Mm. You know, and it's like, you know, it kind of goes to what you just said there, Ed, as well, and like, you know, you kind of have to say it repeatedly. But that's something that is kind of, again, these, you know, kind of said it's a joke, but it's not really. And there's a lot of truth in that, as in, you know, yes, I know it's your, but like, you know, just move on and get on with it and just, you know, say it in that way and it will kind of be received better.
I'm so sensitive to the moment. I've gone into full militant role because I don't like it when female members of the teams suggest to make coffee. And that's ridiculous, because just because you're, you know, a female, of course you can make coffee or ask for, but it, and also taking notes or any of the more administrative pieces. I'm so militant, it triggers me. And of course it's fine, you know, it has to be equal. But I think it's because we see in business so many gender roles.
And it's gonna take a lot of time to sort of shift people and rethink that and reshape that. And we have to call it out. Every time it happens, we've got to be confident, call it out and address, and you know, address it and say, look, this is just not, because if we don't, it's nobody else, it's not going to change.
There was one thing I did the other day when I was just preparing for this. I did a couple of surveys. You guys might know these, but I'd never come across them before, and they were about bias, you know, and it was about, the one I did was girls doing learning about engineering and science and things like that, and how they're attributed to masculine type language, and then the humanities, which was attributed to feminine type language. And do you know what, I could even see myself as I was trying to go through this test, you press different keys and it, you know, I started to catch myself out knowing that the science and the engineering being masculine, and the, say, history, humanities, and arts and music being feminine, even though myself are way more into humanities and arts and so forth. I could see it happening. Like, I could really see how that language was going. And I thought that was fascinating. I can't remember the type of survey that they are or how valid. Do you guys know of any of these type of surveys?
There's the Harvard... There's the Harvard unconscious bias.
It might have been that.
Okay.
There's a Scandinavian study, and I can't remember what it is, but they got like really super young kids, like proper toddler age, 2, 3, four max, but like really young. And they put a mock little airplane up with two seats at the front and the seats at the back, and they let the kids go and play with it. And the boys sat in the pilot's seat and the girls went to the kitchen and started helping the passengers at the back. So, I mean, it is scary. And the outcome of that was, it's actually frightening how far we have to go back to intervene in time. If you're talking about 2, 3, 4 year olds, what must have been all of that unseen micro cumulative gender-based activities that you haven't said a word to these kids and you've let them go and play with this thing and they've fallen into gender roles? And it's a real wake-up call. If you're talking about intervening with GCSE kids or A-level kids, or you're trying to do your interventions with professional adults in their 20s, 30s, 40s, look, this has started when they were 3. So, you know, there's some of that. And of course, there's psychology in that. It is in our DNA, you know, in terms of our psychology, particularly, you know, this tribal piece. It's a part of survival. It's instinctive. We are, you know, in terms of the reptilian or our frontal lobes and, you know, and the different brain systems that we're using. And of course, when we're using our higher thinking, we can make, you know, we're into the arts and language and we're, you know, we can rationalize. But actually, if we're under fight or flight, if we're on alert because we're under pressure, targets, money, finance, you know, if we feel any level of threat in our society, our media system keeps us in a constant state of alert. Look at Trump, look at Brexit, look at the far right. You know, we take the species of mammals, we put them in a pressure cooker where they become on alert. They're not using that frontal cortex. They're not using that higher thinking. They're using their fight or flight. And in fight or flight, that's based on your experiences, because you've only got milliseconds to make a decision that you know fits with survival. So it's about how we take that and create psychological safety for people to explore these topics where they're not on alert, they're not using fight or flight, and so that's complex.
Mm-hmm. I think we are what we see. I mean, and like that. But and I mean, if I am like a woman and I am kind of drawn to more female kind of areas, that's fine. But I think, like you said, though, it's the equal opportunity and not to make the assumption and kind of use the language to kind of mold you in a particular way, because that's where you fit in the society, you know, to have that equal kind of playing field where it's fine if you're the typical female or a typical male, as we know it. Yeah. But if you're not, that's also fine.
Exactly. You know? If you fall into gender roles, happy days. But yeah. I want to make sure you're getting paid the same.
Exactly.
There's the same amount of you. If that's all equal, then you fill your boots. If you want to do gender roles, because we do have gender roles, then happy days. But, you know, it's... you are statistically earning 80 pence to every man's pound.
Yeah.
No, like, not good enough.
No, absolutely. Because, of course, we know that, I mean, if you choose to have children, you have to take all the time off and you do kind of miss out, because it tends to happen around a kind of crucial time of maybe you're trying to progress in your career and then you have to have a family because, unfortunately, you can't put that off, you know, for too long. You know, and we're at a huge disadvantage. And I do love what's happening in Sweden with that the fathers have to take the time off as well. So one of my previous classmates, actually, he was taking, I think, 7 months. You know, and at least it does balance it out a little bit, that it kind of, it's not just penalizing the female, but also, I don't want to say also penalizing the male, but the mother isn't necessarily just viewed as a liability.
Yeah.
You know, if the father is going to stay home for 6 months as well, at least it does kind of balance it out a little bit.
And Iceland is a really good case study for that as well, where they forced male paternity leave. Because what's really scary, because they talk about the gender pay gap, don't they? You know, that how much a woman gets paid compared to a man. But actually, the difference between a non-primary caregiving woman, so a woman who has not gone off to provide primary care to children, and women who have not done that, is actually a really big gap. there is still a pay gap between men and women who have not gone out of their career. You know, and that's, and I think that's really, really unacceptable. We tax women for primary caregiving on children, and we tax them for caring for elderly or family members with, you know, disabilities or, mm-hmm. Or special need requirements. And, you know, it's just not okay.
But I just want to say that just quickly, because what Ed was saying there, but and the point that you made previously as well about our attitude as women, because I think with the pay gap, and maybe, I mean, not putting the blame on women, but just again on the society of how we're brought up and how we should behave. I know a consultant told me once, a male consultant, he just kind of looked at me, you knew that he wanted to shake me. And he said, go in there and just ask for it. He said, you have to understand as well that you don't maybe get paid as much as your male colleagues because you won't ask. You go in and nearly, oh, kind of feel like I'm nearly a bother. And it's just, you know, you don't want to bother anybody. And that's kind of so, that's just such a difficult obstacle to overcome as well, I think, as a woman. And he said, but your male colleague will go in and will ask for it. You don't get it. They're not going to say, do you know what? We're just going to match what he's getting, actually, even though you're only asking for this. So yeah. I think, again, a societal issue, isn't it? And it's so deeply embedded in us that we just don't really want to. And
it is. We need to do so much coaching and working. And the problem is, it's twofold. There is a proportion of successful women who have appropriated masculine behaviors in order to fight fairly in this fire with fire environment. You know, I will get the same as you. And but that's not the solution. The solution is we need to, you know, make sure that from a gender perspective, we are support, a bit like Anne and the applications. You know, there are different approaches and different behaviors. And we need to make sure that women are comfortable exactly in that, in, you know, salary negotiations. And I suppose it's a similar theme, Anne, to if you don't think you're 100% of the piece, the female may not apply, whereas the man will give it a shot. And I suppose salary negotiations are going to be similar, aren't they? A bit of like, you know, well, actually, I'll give it a go and I'll ask for, whereas the female may be a bit more reserved to say, well, actually, oh, I've got 80%, but, you know, and we'll find that they're the same trends and the same themes throughout.
If we can just perhaps move on into our closing question. I know that many of our listeners will be from smaller departments with larger companies or even smaller businesses altogether. And so they may feel unable to really get things moving. So just based on everything we've been talking about in this session from ethics and inclusion, you know, what would be, if you guys were tasked with bringing something to improve this today, what would it be? And if I could start perhaps, Josephine, if you could take us off from there.
Yeah, so I would look at both a formal and an informal approach. So the formal approach then being the introduction of an enterprise-wide code of ethics. And I mean, I suppose if for smaller businesses, smaller SMEs, I think there's a great opportunity there, I suppose, to be able to influence and make kind of quick change. So look at bringing in a code of ethics, including compliance, and anti-corruption, conflict of interest, pleasing gifts and gratitude and so on, employee practices, for example, preventing workplace harassment and ensuring equal opportunity and diversity, and ethics and compliance resources, providing ethics advice helplines. So I think, you know, there's a lot of other things, there's more things that need to be included in the code, but I think those are the most important, you know, with what we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. And yep. Then the informal approach then being the example set by leaders and the embedded organizational culture. So basically just ensuring that bringing from the formal approach of having the codes and then making sure that they are lived, they translate to what's actually happening in the organization, set, you know, that's the behaviors that are allowed to happen that will create the culture, and anyone else entering into the company, that's what they will see, that's what they will experience, it becomes the norm. So that then becomes how your working culture that will assist in what we've been talking about today.
And if I could just ask you, if there was anything today that you could bring something new in all the things that we've been talking about, you know, what would it be?
I think going back to Ed and both Josephine is you can't bite off just one bit. to tackle inclusivity, if you generally want your business to change and being more inclusive, you've got to think about how are we attracting the talent in the first place, so the recruitment process, how are we looking after the staff once they're in the workspace, the staff around them and everybody that understands that you're operating inclusively. But that also goes to the physical space. So if you're a manufacturing environment and on your shop floor you've got male toilers and the female has to go trooping up to the office, the administrative block, 200 metres up the plumbing factory, then you have not created an inclusive working environment. So it is looking at the whole package and considering that as a whole entirety. And so, I think don't bite off one bit.
It's the whole thing, the whole deal. Thanks so much. And Ed, if I could just finish with you with the same question, you know, what would you bring new today? What would it be?
I would do a reset, a stop, pause and reflect from an individual basis. We know McKinsey has, you know, upsides. We know that there are solutions. We know there's tons of stuff up, but just stop for a moment as the individual and have a look at your circle of trust. So if you had a crisis right now in your life, something happened, write down the people that you would talk to it about. Write down who would you say if you were in financial trouble, relationship trouble. Write that list out and have a look at that and have a look at how diverse that is. What are the age groups of the people on that circle of the trust? Do they look like you? Are they the same age? Do they come from the same ethnic background? Are they the same gender by and large? Actually profile your real private circle of trust. And if you notice in that there isn't a diversity of thought, of ethnicity, of culture, of age, then it's a moment for us to say, actually, we have an individual responsibility to go out and learn and include that diversity of thought in our thinking. And it's the same in business. If you look around you and you're having these conversations, you are not, putting yourself out there. And an argument I had recently was staff network groups, D&I communities, everybody can bring a horse to water. But it's you as the individual that needs to care. You know, we're coming into Trans Awareness Week. What do we know about it? We've heard of J.K. Rowling and all that sort of stuff, but are you getting your information from clicking on Facebook, or are you talking to people from those communities? Disability, Black, Asian, minority community, do you really understand their barriers? Do you care? So my challenge is to the individual to take a moment of reflection and having a real conversation about how up for a diversity and inclusion conversation am I really? Because cumulatively, if I'm nodding the head and tokenism and talking about it, and of course it's all bad and we need to fix it, but taking no active, if we're all passive allies, we'll get nowhere. We really need to stand up for the other communities by being active, and that's understanding their lived experiences.
Thanks so much, Ed. And thanks to you all. I really appreciate the input today, and it certainly we got off to some really interesting discussions, and myself learning so much as well, of course. So I really appreciate it.
Ben, thank you. Take care.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you very much. All the best now. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.